Will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Dunphy?
Aye.
Senator Sherman?
Aye.
Senator Stroh?
Aye.
Senator Skeel?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. Motion passes and we'll ask Senator Crail to be chair of the Building Department. Thank you very much. Go back to room 41. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1141. Okay, we have staff here from Senator Deuce's office to take some forward.
Chair members of the committee, Senate Bill 1141 is sponsored by Senator Deuce and it establishes a chain ombudsman with the Department of Human Resources. We heard testimony from the Department of Human Resources and Senator Deuce last week, the 19th. We're bringing it back today with the Dash 2 amendments that were some modifications offered by the department. And please, if anyone has any questions, it's actually the amendments change the language ombudsman to advocate. And it also changes the appointment of the person from the governor's office to the director of the Department of Resources, and that's it.
Any further explanation?
I think she did just fine. Okay.
Yes.
So Senator Deuce is okay with these amendments? Is there? Okay.
Well, I'll move the Dash 2 amendments, Mr. Chair. Okay, Senator Duncan moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1141. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none? So ordered.
I move Senate Bill 1141 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves Senate Bill 1141 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as it's amended. Further discussion? Hearing none, then we'll call the roll.
Senator
Kennedy?
Aye.
Senator
Stroh?
Aye.
Senator
Fisher?
Aye. Senator Duncan? Aye. Senator Fisher? Aye. That carries, and I would guess that Senator Deuce would be glad to carry this bill, and if you could keep it. I can hear that through, and thank you for coming. I appreciate the help. Close the work session on Senate Bill 1141 and open the work session on Senate Bill 421. Grover Simmons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons, representing the adult foster home industry. The Dash 1 amendment is the status of the bill that we'd like the committee to consider and act upon favorably. The essence of the bill currently is on page 2, where it says complainants, participants, and witnesses who knowingly and intentionally submit a false complaint or testimony shall not have immunity from civil or criminal liability. That's really the thrust of the bill. We believe it's a litmus test for honesty in government. It's the language is clear. It's an endorsement of honesty, and it's an opportunity to take a stand on that particular point. So we respectfully ask the committee to act favorably on the bill.
And you did discuss this with your constituents?
Yes, sir, we did.
And your members?
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have from prior testimony and hearings that we've conducted on this bill, You might still have the Dash 1 amendments, which is what Grover just referred to, and there were submitted by Senator Castillo the Dash 2 amendments.
What are Senator Castillo's Dash 2 amendments?
Dash 2 amendments, I believe, just took out the very line that Grover was just referring to. On page 2, line 8, they emboldened print. Deleted that language. I was after talking with several people, it seemed that the language in this paragraph, that last sentence, sounds sort of confused and made it even more difficult to understand what this whole entire paragraph was trying to accomplish. And it was, I offered it in an effort to clean up this language and still keep with the main point that was trying to be made here in this in the language here of starting on line 4. So that's the amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I asked, I didn't ask. I was in the company of some lawyers, and this came up, and I handed this paragraph to somebody to read with the dash one, and the point that they made is that in a sense, lines 8, 9, and 10 aren't needed. If you read line 4, it says, anyone participating in good faith and in the making of a complaint pursuant to this section who has reasonable grounds for the making thereof shall have immunity. And they immediately said, the converse is also true, that if they aren't participating in good faith in the making of the complaint, they don't have the immunity, which is what the lines 8, 9, and 10 are about, if you follow what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So the opening line of the paragraph negates the necessity of the dash 1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, if the converse is also true, therefore no damage should or harm should result from putting in clarifying language. 2 years ago, we dealt with the issue of good faith in this whole subject of making complaints, and we simply couldn't get it through the Senate as a whole. This committee did pass it out with a recommend. They passed it out of committee. And then the Senate had some difficulty with the issue of good faith, the whole concept of good faith. So this time, 2 years later, we've come back with amended language, which was recommended by the lady who was previously the staff person to this very committee. So it's her language. And we think it is clearer, and it certainly is a clean up or down vote on the issue of honest government.
Mr. Chair, I'm Senator. I'm friendly member of the discussion with Senator Bryant. Well, what it was basically what Senator Shields said, plus the fact that Senator Bryant was of the opinion, I believe, that this made it more difficult.
Right.
It put in two other things that had to be proven over what's in there right now in order to prosecute someone that had done this or could have been perceived to have done this. And they are aware of that.
Yeah.
And discussed that with their members and still wish to have this in here.
In other words, Mr. Chair, Senator Bryant agreed with the attorney basically that I talked to?
In my non-professional opinion.
Yes.
That was the reason for my amendment.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask Senator Shields, then, what Grover just asked, the converse, okay, what's your response to his question? I know you're not a witness today, but...
We don't mind.
He says, Grover just said that when I say that the converse is true, that participating in good faith would mean that if you're not participating in good faith, you wouldn't be immune. He says, therefore, why not add this language? And I simply say, don't add it, because as Senator Bryant says, it makes it more confusing and it adds two other criteria that aren't there. I think our job is to keep the law as simple and as clean as possible and not provide any more jobs than we have to for lawyers.
And
it was
an attorney from the Oregon Law Center that pointed out the exact same thing that Senator Bryant said in this, and that was what prompted my amendment.
Well, I think, if I understand what Mr. Simmons is bringing forth here, that they feel that the common person reading this does not automatically read in the other side of the coin. And I would have to agree with that to a certain extent, because I know myself that many times I've been caught up here in legislation not realizing that, for instance, in my first session here, we had a bill that addressed a matter of somebody doing some work, and it was perceived not to have financial fiscal impact. But in reality, reading the other side of it, if somebody does the work, they have to get paid, so it did have a fiscal impact, and yet the common person reading that would not pick that up from that, and the attorney automatically saw through that. And I think that's the question here, as I see it. They probably realize that this is something that is probably not ever going to be used in a court case against anyone probably making a complaint. It only serves to warn someone that reading this, that they do have an obligation to do a truthful and intentionally true statement.
Mr. Chair, then I guess as a committee, are we in agreement, or is there still some discussion? At one point,
I don't know until we take a vote.
There was some concern at one point that we would discourage people. Has that been dealt with now?
Well, as far as my own personal feeling is, if somebody is discouraged by the writing in there of making it intentionally and willfully untrue statement, scare somebody off from making a complaint, I would have serious doubt in my mind the complaint was valid. You're going to sit here and tell me that I'm in trouble if I make a false complaint, if I'm scared off on a statement like that and I believe it's true, then I guess I don't have much backbone or anything else, because this plainly tells them that if they have a reason to believe in good faith that they have a complaint, that they're going to be immune from prosecution, and follows it up and just basically says if they don't give a true statement, they don't have that immunity. And so I can't see how it has the so-called full chilling effect on somebody bringing a complaint, because they have to do it in good faith and true and honest circumstances. At least that's my answer.
Mr. Chair, I understand what you're saying, but I also believe that you and I and the members of this committee have been relatively successful in our endeavors and have a lot more kind of self-confidence, and we have positive self-images, and we wouldn't be nearly as frightened by the unknown as somebody who's maybe working at minimum wage and has, you know, a job that is, you know, kind of, it's far from being the kind of rewarding careers that maybe we've had. So that, I don't think we can put ourselves in the position of that person. Yeah, we might think that they don't have much background, but in fact, we've not walked in their shoes.
Going back and forth.
You know what I'm saying? We just haven't walked in their shoes to know how a person at the bottom of the totem pole would feel in making a complaint when they wouldn't know what the response or the reaction would be.
I, having dealt with many, many, many employees that have just come to me and started them out on their first job, I'm not willing to agree that they don't have a lot more comprehension of that than you would indicate. I have found people to be pretty willing to work, and I've gotten my best suggestions and best help out of people from that very category, and actually operating my business, because they're out there working on the front lines and they understand it, and they're not afraid to speak up basically And I think you want to get down to it. The average 15, 16-year-old kid on the street, walking the street, knows the law probably better than the people that are out there trying to make them behave. At least they sure seem to be able to use it. And our criminal population certainly is as expert in tying up the legal field and ferreting out things and stuff like that as some of our best legal minds. And so I'm not really going to impute into people just because they haven't had the education some others have had, the fact that they aren't able to see through what's true and false and willing and understanding that enough to know that they're safe and they can complain as long as they do it in good faith.
Mr. Chair, I we consider that he's had the legislators a bit more is that experience really not afraid? Sometimes I should appear and look at this audience. Yes, I'm scared to death. You know, nobody's really good, so I don't know. It's a tough one.
Well, when you come right down to it, you were saying you didn't want to impugn their motives or their strengths or weaknesses. I guess, you know, as you look at it, you're looking at them as an employer. And you've certainly had some very good experiences with employees who've shown initiative and courage and strength. I guess I see them at the other end. Sometimes as a pastor, I see them as people that have really been defeated and kind of beaten down. And that's when they're most frightened. And that's when this kind of a thing, I think, would be intimidating.
Well, yeah. Like I said, if we take a vote, we won't know.
Go ahead. I mean, are we voting on one or two or
what? I would what were your amendments, the dash one or two? I forgot. The dash one?
They were dash one, yeah.
I would entertain a motion for the dash one amendment.
Well, I'll move the dash one.
Senator Shannon moves the dash one amendment. Senate Bill 421. Further discussion? Suggestion?
Jack?
We have
one amendment.
Will clerk call the roll?
Summerfield?
No.
Senator Christina?
No.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Cameron?
Aye.
Senator Cameron?
Aye. Motion carries. Entertain a motion to adopt the bill.
I move the Senate bill.
421.
Yeah, 421 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Shannon moves the Senate bill 421 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I have one other question.
Yes.
I understand I'm looking at the direction that the unsubstantiated complaints against foster care homes, adult foster care homes, are to be filed with the department to be clearly marked, and that they would be maintaining separate files for substantiated and unsubstantiated complaints. So how would that work then if someone is going to place an elderly relative into a home and they wanted to look at the records of the foster care home? When they ask to see the records, would they get to see all of it?
Right.
It's just that the unsubstantiated would be clearly marked.
Yes.
Okay. I understand. Thank you.
Understand.
Before I go, I just want to make it clear that if this is abuse, the next time some people come here and say they were intimidated or whatever, there'll be problems.
Well, I think we had a lot of potential with any bill we passed. But it certainly, just because we pass it in one session doesn't mean it can't be scrutinized in another session.
Right.
Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator
No.
Senator
Hudson? Aye.
Senator
Aye.
No.
Aye. Motion carries, and I will carry the bill on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm members of the committee.
I'm going to serve notice of a minority report.
All right.
Is that possible?
I'm not sure.
Hmm? You say possible, I'm not sure.
Yeah, turning over the possible manual. I have to contact her about 5 o'clock.
Okay.
Senator Shields has issued a notice of possible minority report on Senate Bill 421, and that's duly noted in the record, and I believe the requirement is that he will have to notify administrative staff by 5 o'clock this evening, April 28th, 1999, to initiate that, and that the motion carries.
Thank you, Chair.
And I, well, that's for myself. I'm not sure I heard the sentence before. I still will probably want to double check with Senator Bryan on some concerns I had on certain input.
I close the session on Senate Bill 421 and open the work session on Senate Bill 824, Lisa Gilliam and Hirsch Crawford.
Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 824, we heard a public hearing last week, April 22nd, is requesting to eliminate the prior authorization requirement for vaccinating antihistamines and nasal inhaler prescribed to participants in the Oregon Health Plan. We have the Dash 1 amendment before us. The Dash 1 amendment is to allow specialists to be automatically exempt from prior authorization requirement under the Oregon Health Plan. And it specifies for treating chronic and or severe cases of asthma, sinusitis, rhinitis, or allergies.
Okay.
And
which one is this? Do you want to go ahead and start on this? Or?
I will. You've seen the amendment to the bill on the prior authorization for the record. My name is Lisa Scott Gilliam. The amendment is before you, and Mr. Crawford and I talked this morning, and he suggested a few minor changes to the amendment, which I agree with are fine with me, and I'll let him cover his changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Rich Crawford, Office of Medical Assistance Programs. We would be prepared to support the amendment that Ms. Gilliam has proposed with the following changes. We would like to delete lines 24 through 28 on the printed bill, which was the original language which was in the bill, and then modify the language on the Dash 1 amendment so that it reads as follows. The division is not authorized to require prior authorization for a legend drug falling within the following therapeutic classes as defined by rule by the division, and those therapeutic classes are non-sedating antihistamines and nasal inhalers, that is prescribed by an allergist for the treatment of any of the following conditions as described by the Health Services Commission on the funded portion of the prioritized list. And the following conditions are asthma, sinusitis, rhinitis, or allergies. What the effect of these amendments do is allow allergists to prescribe non-sedating antihistamines without prior authorization for conditions that are covered by the Oregon Health Plan. And we're prepared to support that amendment.
Okay. And that's each of your approval, too?
Thank you.
That's a little broad for conceptual. Would you be favorable to doing that on the House side to spur this along?
Yes, sir.
We have a crazy situation. We only have 5 bills from the House to look at this point in time, so we have practically no House, but we're running a little bit behind here. So If we could hustle these on through, it would be a help.
Mm-hmm.
So you would recommend that we don't adopt any amendments?
Mr. Chair, we have no intention of changing this any further on the House side. We're satisfied with this as it reads.
That's what I say. So we would,
With Mr. Crawford's changes.
We would just move the bill with our recommendation that it be changed on the House side?
Oh, sure. Yes. Yes, that's fine. Is that okay with you?
No. Far should be adopted H1.
Okay.
And go that far. And then have the base one amended effectively on the House side. Would that be?
Mr. Chair, I hate to say this, but we are not prepared to support the bill as it is currently written or the unamended -1 amendments.
I have a concern about that too.
I do myself. That's why I'm trying to find out here. I'm just going to go ahead and make the decision to close the work session on this because I think we've reached agreement. Let's get them to LCF really as fast as we can. I'm pretty certain that we'll have a meeting or two next week that we can continue to.
Let me ask a question. Yes. Within the hour, couldn't we hand in grocer?
That's concerning.
Okay. Well, what I'm saying, what I guess I'm saying is it could be hand engrossed so that we could at least see it, because what Hirsch was saying was fairly complicated. And even though it doesn't make it from LC back, we could have it smaller.
Well, but LC wouldn't, they haven't passed judgment necessarily on what he's done either, so there could be some change into that. And I think that we'd best.
So you think that we'll be back together now?
I promise tomorrow for a specific purpose, and I'm trying to keep that inviolate. So I'm going to close the conversation on that and direct the staff to get that amendment.
So we have time tomorrow, then
we should have time Monday to do that. Close the work session on Senate Bill 421 and open a H24, and open a work session on Senate Bill 582.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 582 is at the request of the Payments of the Management Task Force. We had a hearing on this bill on the 15th of April. It modifies the definition of the intractable pain law. At that time, we heard from Ted Schick from the Board of Medical Examiners and Margaret Murphy Carley. The Board of Medical Examiners were in opposition of deleting the second consultation requirement. Margaret and Dr. Hicks have since worked together, came up with a -1 amendment. What the -1 amendments do is they expand the second consultation requirement. It is more clear. It helps. It will assist attending physicians in determining when the second consultation will be necessary. The -1 amendments are providing for alternative forms of meeting the second consultation requirements, putting it at the discretion of the board to evaluate possible alternative situations. It also is identifying that pain specialists do not need to seek a second consultation.
Yeah. Has that been passed with the past grant agency?
Yes, sure. Right. I gave it to him. I haven't
heard
it.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw it.
Did you know that here?
Did you know?
Grant agency here. Yeah. I don't think that violates anything that we discussed on symptoms, really. It actually makes it easier to spell it out and clarifies a situation that I think was really what the law was meant to provide. It's original. Yes.
Thank you.
Do you know if any of the supporters of the bill have seen the amendment and are okay with the amendment?
In the committee for the record, I'm Glenn Dayton from Mortgage Care Association. I have not been working on this bill, but I know from conversations with Margaret that the latest amendments have been reviewed and approved by the people that have been working on the bill. It's my understanding that they represent a consensus point of view. Again, not having worked on it directly, but just talking with her, that's my understanding.
Thank you. Yeah, I would entertain a motion for the Dagshorn amendments.
So moved.
Senator Shannon has moved the Dagshorn amendments to Senate Bill 582, and is there further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
I move Senate Bill 582 to the floor. As amended, is that in order?
Yes. Senator Shannon has moved Senate Bill 582 as amended to the Senate floor, and that was a due pass.
Yes, with a due pass, right.
Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will clerk call the roll?
Senator
Duncan?
Aye.
Senator
Shannon?
Aye.
Senator
Shields?
Aye.
Senator
Steele?
Aye.
Senator Steele?
Aye.
Motion carries. Have someone that was carry the bill. Thank you very much. Close the work session on Senate Bill 582 and open a public work session on Senate Bill 744.
Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 44 is allowing women to breastfeed infants in public. We had a public hearing on this early in March. We heard a fair amount of all positive testimony on the benefits of breastfeeding. Senator Shannon and Senator Brown went aside and worked on some amendments. We have before us the Dash 1. The Dash 1 amendment changes the word infant in the bill, line 4, and inserts child, and it deletes the cause of action language on Dash 9 5.
Just curiosity. What was just an infant child? I was just curious. I was wrapped that on down the line to Senator.
Well, in the first place, I never seen these amendments. I'm sorry, and I don't support it because it's already legal. And I think the difference in infant child is some people nurse their kids till they're 2 and 3 years old. I don't think watching kids are called infants. So I don't know. But I think that this is women have this right, and anybody that wants to have a problem, it's their problem because it's the law. And we can't pass a law that makes women act on their rights. They already have the right.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7. At the committee's direction, I did a little homework since we last had this bill in front of us. And I talked to a woman by the name of Elizabeth Baldwin. She's an attorney in Florida and has a fairly extensive knowledge of what's happening across the nation. She actually practices in she has family law, but she's developed a specialty in the breastfeeding arena. I didn't even know such a thing existed, but she's been working with folks across the United States to make sure legislation enacted is appropriate. She sent to me numerous examples of what states are doing, and she suggested changes in the bill. One, to change infant to child so that there would be no debate over whether the age limits for breastfeeding, et cetera. The other suggestion she made, which I did not do because I didn't have a sense that the committee was willing to go there, was she accepted that the language be changed to allow the mother to breastfeed anywhere the mother is allowed to be, whether public or private place. I did not make that amendment. Texas has that statute. Several other states have that statute. I left it simply in a public place. And then, given signals I got from committee members about the private cause of action, we just simply deleted that.
There are some states that have that. There are also states, I believe New Jersey, that established penalties, some fine system, but I just didn't feel like we needed to go there. The other thing is I provided to Senator Shannon an executive order that was passed in the state of California, which extensively went through the reasons for breastfeeding and encouraged state employees to provide facilities for employees to breastfeed or to express milk. I'm not sure whether I was able to ascertain whether the governor of the state of California, Ben Pete Wilson, signed the executive order, but I have talked with the governor's office, and they're at least a minimal, but would ask us, of course, to go through the legislative process first. The other thing that I was able to locate this morning, I know that the committee was also interested in doing a tax credit. Apparently, no states have done this at this point in time, and I met with Betsy Earle's AOI to talk about some other ways to motivate businesses to make breastfeeding friendly workplaces. And we have some ideas. It's just at this point we don't feel like we can move forward to them. What I did want to share with the committee is the Texas statute that they passed, which allows businesses to designate themselves as a mother-friendly and requires that the business meet certain criteria before they can be designated as such. So I think that's the way to go. I just feel really strongly that we need to move forward and making sure and protecting women's right to breastfeed in public. And I'm willing to work with committee members on the House side. I know that there are other folks on the House side that are interested in this issue to deal with the employer piece. But I don't feel like we've been able to pull things together at this point to address that issue right today. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I have a question.
Senator Shannon.
Senator Brown, do you know of any breastfeeding public employee that denied the opportunity to breastfeed their child?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, no, I don't know that it's been an issue for public employees, and that's why we didn't move forward on that particular language. The reason why I feel it strongly to clarify women's right to breastfeed in public is that you heard several women here at the last time this bill was heard that were either asked to leave the store or asked to go elsewhere in order to breastfeed, or B, the woman that was basically harassed. She and her child were harassed for her breastfeeding her infant, and I feel strongly that we need to move forward with the legislation.
So, not law question, at least. Isn't it true that that grocery store chain apologized for that clerk's action?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, they maybe did. I think the part of the point of the legislation is an education tool, and to make sure that folks know that it's okay to breastfeed and to encourage and promote breastfeeding. So the store maybe apologized. There was certainly the incident still at the Clackamas Recreational Center. And so.
This strikes me as extremely similar to Senate Bill 421 that we just talked about, where even though this may be all right by law right now, it doesn't specifically state it, and therefore it's difficult to, you have to make the case every time it comes up, whereas if it plainly states it here, somebody can be able to probably carry a copy of that around, shove it in somebody's nose if they need to. So I think we've got the same situation here, and I think for the my own inclination is to go ahead and adopt this. For that reason, if no other reason, just the fact that we're putting it plainly on record, and somebody may not be able to draw it. Maybe our store employees and a few other people aren't highly educated enough to draw that inference without it being there.
Sir, I'd just like to say one other thing. Yeah. I breastfed 2 children in public, private, whenever they were hungry. I just want to tell you, I was never harassed. There's a warm feeling that goes over you when you watch a mother feed her baby, whether there's a blanket or a little something covering it to make it discreet or not. And I just, everybody likes to hear bawling baby stop. I just think that this is, if this is what you think it needs to help women stand up for the baby's rights, but frankly, I found that mamas are as tough as mother bears when they're trying to harass them with their baby in their arms. And I just have such great faith in women. I don't think they need it. But if you think they do, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I understand why Senator Shannon would not be harassed. She's careful.
I didn't say that.
However, in defense of women who might not have all the guts that Senator Shannon has, I think we should approve this amendment and this bill.
Is that a motion?
That's a motion. That's more of a commotion than a motion, but it's a motion.
I think Senator Shields has said all that needs to be said.
Yeah, amen.
Follow this one up.
Senator Shields turned on saying anything else.
And I take that Senator Shields has moved it to adopt the Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 744.
That's right.
Further discussion or objections hearing none, so ordered. You wish to?
Yeah, let's move it to the floor with, as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Senate Bill 774 as amended has been moved to the floor with a due pass amendment by Senator Shields. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, I'm going to clerk call the roll.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator
Steele?
Aye.
Senator
Brown? Aye. Senator Fisher? Aye. And Senator, excuse me, Senator Brown, I'm afraid.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. Thank you very much for your time.
I'm glad to help.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 744 and open the work session on Senate Bill 769. Okay. Ask the Board of Pharmacy to come forward here and Reese Merton. Okay.
Chair, members of the committee, 769 is Senate Bill 769 allows for voluntary labeling of prescription medication with physical description, including an identification code. We had a public hearing on the bill on April 5th. At the request of individuals that were present at that hearing, we had an informal work group where a couple of issues could be addressed. Representation from that work group was present to make a statement of agreement that was an outcome of that work group meeting.
Okay. And we also wish to read into the record a letter from Script Pro Pharmacy Automation. And it states their mission to develop a state-of-the-art automated prescription dispensing system for community outpatient pharmacies, and they would be designed to the requirements of the proposed accuracy label rule. So we'll put that into the record. Go ahead. I'm not sure. Excuse me, Senator.
I'm not sure. Are there some amendments?
No, this is just an agreement that may have been reached outside. And we,
so we won't do it.
No,
they won't do it. Okay. All right.
We want this on the record.
Right.
Yes, they have reached an agreement.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lise Merton with the National Association of Chain Drug Stores, representing quite a number of chains in the state of Oregon. I am going to relinquish my seat to Mark Watt, who is with Fred Meyer, who was part of the group that came to agreement, and also Tom Holt is here with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. I'll let members of the board and these others who are actually part of the agreeing group discuss the terms of the agreement, but I would like to request that 769 be withdrawn for consideration. Based on the agreement that's been reached, we're very pleased with the outcome. We're looking forward to working with the board And I think we can move forward in harmony from here forward. So I want to thank you very much for hearing and for also allowing us to come before you today.
I'll let you folks proceed if you wish your order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Holt. I'm executive director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Our membership includes approximately 230 independent pharmacies who are affected by this rule. We had, and I'll let Mike, I'll defer to Mike to describe, you know, the details of the agreement, but we had a very long and detailed conversation about how we can implement the rule and meet everyone's needs in terms of timelines and having the information available to meet its requirements. We'll have, in effect, a two-year implementation, and I believe the board has a letter or a memo to submit for the record outlining that agreement. I think we're all quite happy with it and pleased that we were able to come to agreement. So if you have to answer any questions.
Okay.
Mike Patrick, president of the Board of Pharmacy this year. We came to an agreement with some people from NACDF and other members to go back in March. At our March meeting, we set back the date to start the accuracy level to July 1st of 2000 to take it off of the magic number of January 1st of 2000. What we agreed basically to do is to still have the implementation date of July 1st of 2000 and have a date of June 30th of the year of 2002 as a date by which all these systems should be up and running. What we will do is write some rules to help cover the interim period. Those rules basically would say that we will not enforce the rule until the year June 30th, 2002. What we will do is submit a letter to the company that to see what kind of progress they're making, and then have a time period for which they will report back to the board what kind of efforts they're making to comply with the rule. And as long as they report back in the time limit, there'll be no fine or no penalty. And as long as you know they're working towards implementation, which can be very agreeable.
Thank you.
Briefly.
Senator Fisher, for the record, my name is Marcus Watt with Fred Meyer. We're just very happy to have been part of this process. We feel that with the rule changes that we discussed, that we can meet the deadline and go forward from this point.
Thank you. I also have a letter from Pat Amadeo, mm-hmm. and that speaks to this agreement on behalf of the Oregon Community Pharmacy Council, and that expresses their key points of agreement, and that will be entered into the record. I appreciate the opportunity to put this on record, and if there's no further testimony, could you...
Mr. Chair, just briefly, and members of the committee, I just wanted to say I'm for the record, my name is Gary Schnabel. I'm the compliance director and acting executive director for the Board of Pharmacy. I was in attendance at the meeting as well to work out this agreement. I wrote a letter to Tom Holt of the OSPA and also a fax memo to make some clarification after a question was brought forward by NACDF. And I would be happy to clarify those or just submit these for the record.
Submit them and put them in the record. Okay. The staff will make that known.
You have those? Yeah. A letter of April 15th? Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have that attached to the staff agent summary and background information, but you can submit it again if you want.
All right.
Senator Fisher, if I could make one more comment.
Sure.
Part of our agreement was that there was some concern among some of our members that there be additional disciplinary actions tied to the noncompliance of this. We have agreed that there will be none, and we'd like to have that added to the record.
All right. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate the matter of getting this on record, and this will be a bill we'll relegate to the...
Mr. Chairman, this does put all this on record that we don't need to do this. And we just...
Right.
Now, they're going to continue to work it.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 769 and open the work session on Senate Bill 977 when we have amendments.
Chair members of the committee, Senate Bill 977 originally requires local commission on children and families to include local plans for child care services for children with primary caregivers have specific disabilities. We have the Gaston Amendment, which basically removes that account from the local commissions and that plan from the local commissions and places it into a flexible pool of funding in the child care division of the employment department. Basically, it replaces the original bill. And we have a brochure that can address that.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I notice we don't have any sum in it, and I believe this goes ways and means.
Yes, it does.
Okay. So maybe we need to have that addressed as to amounts, or if amounts are known. Go ahead.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, I'm Tom Olson, the Ministry of Childcare Division. Since our previous hearing, when you requested some information approximately what this might cost, we've done some initial research on the numbers of folks that we speculate might be able to be served by this bill. We've found that there are approximately 225 individuals that are developmentally delayed or disabled in Oregon that also are parents. And by calculating that out at the cost of estimated cost of child care, quality child care for a year, which is, runs about $4,000 to $6,000, and looking at it biannually, we have a range of costs on the handout I hope you received. Serving 10% of that population would cost approximately $135,000 per biennium.
Where is this handout? Excuse me.
The costs are at 10% of the population, the costs are approximately $275,000 per biennium. To serve 25% of the population, the cost would be about $675,000 per biennium. And at 50% of the population, the cost would be approximately $1.35 million per biennium. And that's the best estimate we've been able to arrive at.
Okay, what would your best estimate of which one of those figures would need to be?
I think that 50% of this population is a logical base to work from, because this population is very low income. Not many folks that are developmentally delayed parents have a lot of income, and I would guess that most would qualify, and it would be just would be a matter of what's available in the general fund, frankly, to fund the program, and we would certainly work with whatever amount the legislature thought would be suitable.
So at 50%, that was
$1.35 million. And we're assuming that not every, this would not be a situation, of course, where the families would be required to take this care. It would be purely voluntary. So this 50% number is probably about as accurate as my guess.
Okay.
Question?
Yes, Senator Shields.
The 50%, the 1.35 million, that's 50% of the population that you named earlier.
Right.
How many?
Of approximately 225.
50% of 225 people. I guess I'm wanting to make a point here for the committee that we're talking about 225 people with this kind of disability to become parents, sometimes not even knowingly, so it's too late, you know. I just ask you to think about that. Some of us yesterday had a chance to meet one of these parents.
Yeah.
Loving parents, trying to do everything they can do, but just I can see that parent being outrun by their child in a few years, you know. But if they don't get some help, certainly will be retarded.
Yes, Senator.
Sure.
When I look at the picture, they're from Washington. Or bodyguards.
Well, I look at the fiscal impact in action, and I realize you're talking about a lot of money. And I guess, again, we hear this term oftentimes, but I really believe it. You're talking about an investment. And I guess I'm convinced that the cost saving, I mean, putting aside the humanitarian thing, it's the right thing to do. If you're looking at Hopkins Report, I think, in a sense,
if we don't talk too long, we'll be able to do it.
That's right. We'll do it. We'll do it. I'll wait for it.
Well, I have a comment.
Yes, sir.
I want to be sure.
I did the right thing. Well, it's not mentioned here, but anyway, Senate Bill, how does this work with Senate Bill 919 that you're going to deal with a little later? Would you look at and compare this with Senate Bill 919? It says that the mentally retarded people in the community, if I as I read it, shall have these new services.
I can see that connection. It's down and under the file here.
It says that the
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Yes.
Senate Bill 919 will be addressed in a little bit. The Daslin amendments were proposed by Catherine Wright and I believe James Keene. And it's their truth amendment totally replaces that bill. And the amendment 919 is basically addressing the folks on the wait list that they've been dealing with for several years. So 919 is
as adverse to parents with
right.
Excuse me, it has what?
That just refers to people on the waiting list for mental health services, not the parents of.
No, but the way I see the connection is these mental health. It says mentally retarded, emotionally disturbed, alcohol abusers, drug dependent persons, all this. They're on the waiting list. Now we're going to set them up in services outside of their parents' home so they can be parents, so we can put these retarded new parents' kids in this new program. I see a connection.
It's a different population, Senator Shannon. Yeah. We're talking about children who aren't developmentally disabled. In the current bill we're looking at, their parents are, but the children aren't, and they're going to get the support services they need that their parents need help with. The other bill deals with people who do have, who are developmentally disabled and need services from the state.
Okay.
So we are talking.
Let me explain. We're dealing with people on the waiting list that are fertile and mentally retarded and into their parents' care. And when we pass 919, we move them out in the community, set them up in apartments, they become pregnant, then we have to increase the funds in the bill we're talking with now. And just there is a connection. And if these kids are faced with their parents now, I'm not sure we're doing everybody a great favor moving them out there so they can be independent, no parents, and then start producing kids so we can increase the funds in the bill we're working with now. I see a connection.
Well, this is true. I guess I would, if there is a connection, whatever the problem is, this one exists.
Mm-hmm.
And however it happens, these children, we need to be providing for these kids because we're going to have, the costs are going to be compounded greatly if we don't put that.
Well, believe me, just because the kids are home with parents doesn't necessarily mean they don't get pregnant either. Whether the parents are retarded or not.
Well, it's time.
You wait here. Yeah, I'll move the Daslin amendments.
Okay, Senator Duncan has moved the Daslin amendments to Senate Bill 977. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move that 9771 as amended defense floor of the due pass. No, raise means with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves Senate Bill 977 as amended by the basement amendments to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator
Steele? Aye. Senator Fields?
Aye.
Senator Duffy?
Aye.
Senator
Cameron?
Aye.
Senator Smith? Aye. Motion carries. And ready to wait. Close the work session on Senate Bill 977 and open the work session on Senate Bill 1027. Do you have a transaction?
Yeah.
Go ahead and describe it.
Mr. Chairman, this is Senate Bill 1027. We had, once again, a public hearing on it on the 19th of April. This is establishing an uninsured access to hospice program to provide access to hospice care for uninsured persons in Oregon. 1027 has prior reference to Ways and Means. It has, it appropriates money and the Hospice Association is here to answer any questions. There are no amendments on this bill.
I would entertain a motion to remove this vote from raising it.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Bill 1027. Are we sending to Ways and Means?
Yes.
Ways and Means for the due pass recommendation.
Also, while we're at it, I'm going to enter a letter here into the record from Alan Garcia, MPH, the Executive Director of the Hospice of Edmonds Sisters in Grant County, President of the Oregon Association for Home Care, and the support of Senate Bill 1027. Any further discussion? I wasn't sure that Senator Shields has moved that we send Senate Bill 1027 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none. Clerk call the roll.
Senator Duffy?
Aye. Motion carries. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1027 and motion our work session on Senate Bill 210. We have amendments and Nancy Ellis.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 210 is a technical bill that is bringing Oregon statutes into compliance with federal governing groups. An insurance code statute, and we got the dashboard back yesterday, and I'm hoping everybody's had a chance to look at them and provide any answers to any of these questions.
Somebody briefly go over what that covers is.
Go ahead. Whoever's.
Mr. Chairman, this is the committee for the record. I'm Nancy Ellis, Administrator of the Insurance Division of DCBS. As the committee assistant said, this is a technical bill to conform some of the insurance code to portability rule changes recently promulgated by HCFA. The Dash-4 amendments are some changes that we agreed to with some of our stakeholders. Apparently, inadvertently, a couple of the changes were omitted, and we don't believe there's any substantive disagreement between us and any of the stakeholders on the changes. We would hope, in view of the schedule, that you'd be willing to pass the bill out with the Dash-4 amendments, and then we'll commit to making sure that in the House the correct text is put in place over there.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator
Shields. I move the Dash-4 amendments to Senate Bill 210.
Senator Shields has moved the Dash-4 amendments to Senate Bill 210. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 210 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Shields moves Senate Bill 210 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Objections? Further discussion? Hearing none. Clerk call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. We have someone to carry the bill, Senator Shoup.
Yeah, I'll do it.
Okay, Senator Shoup will carry the bill. Close the work session on Senate Bill 210 and open a work session on Senate Bill 540. Ask Dr. Bruce Bowles from OHSU. By the way, once again, I'd like to thank everybody for coming and being patient. Today is the culmination of a whole lot of hard effort by a lot of people who work things out, and I really appreciate it. It's made our time go pretty well here this morning. Go ahead, Dr. Gold.
Chair members of the committee, Senate Bill 520 was heard the first part of April, and this is the bill that creates the Spinal Cord Injury Research Board. At that time, we heard testimony from proponents of the bill, Arwin Berg, who is a victim of spinal cord injury. Committee staff was asked to do some investigation on the stem cell research, and we were able, through Arwin's help, Dr. Gould from OHSU, who is familiar with that, and he is here to address and provide more information regarding spinal cord injury and future tours.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, I wish to express my sincere appreciation to you for inviting me to testify today and giving me the opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 540. I also would like to acknowledge Mr. Charles Byrd for recommending me. For the record, my name is Dr. Bruce Gold, and I should preference my remarks by stating that OHSU has not taken an official position on this bill. I am here to give one example of the types of expertise at OHSU relevant to this bill. I am a scientist at the Center for Research on Occupational Environmental Toxicology, affectionately known as CROIT, at OHSU. CROIT's mission relates to the prevention and treatment of occupational diseases and injuries to the nervous system are commonplace. One of the great enigmas of neuroscience is the failure of nerve cells to regrow, that is, to regenerate, following injury to the spinal cord. It is well known that following such an injury, successful regeneration of nerves in the spinal cord is virtually non-existent. The result is permanent paralysis and loss of sensation in regions of the body below the injury. Prevalence data in the United States indicates the existence of 180,000 cases of spinal cord injury in 1990. Spinal cord injuries take productive people out of Oregon's workforce. They are associated with large dollar as well as human costs. At present, there are no procedures nor drugs available that can restore function following spinal cord injury. In 1992, my laboratory was the first to discover that the immunosuppressant drug, known as FK-506, accelerates regeneration and functional recovery after injury in nerves of rats. Together with a company, Vertex Pharmaceuticals, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we were able to separate out the nerve regenerative and immunosuppressive properties of FK-506 by developing a non-immunosuppressant FK-506 derivative, which was subsequently shown to be orally effective in accelerating nerve regeneration in rats. The development of such a compound with oral efficacy, which is unprecedented, has great therapeutic potential for the treatment of nerve and spinal cord injury. My laboratory has also shown that these compounds increase nerve regeneration in the central nervous system. Specifically, I've studied animal models of Parkinson's disease and spinal cord injury. While to date, our studies of spinal cord injury have been limited to acute injury models in rats, we have made two exciting discoveries. First, FK-506 increases nerve regeneration across the injury site over relatively long, that is, centimeter distances. This has not been achieved with other growth factors to date. Second, FK-506 is able to promote the regeneration of injured nerve cells that do not respond to other growth factors. This work focused on nerve cells that run from the brain to the spinal cord and control motor movement. The foregoing studies were conducted over a period of 3 months and are costly. The cost of these studies is even larger if we are to expand these studies to chronic injury models and other species, including non-human primates. This cost represents a barrier, a major barrier, for generating preliminary data necessary for submission of grant applications, for example, to federal agencies to obtain funding. Another potential source of funding is private industry. To relate my experience in this area, I need to begin by telling you that my recent studies have shed new light on the mechanism by which these compounds work to increase nerve regeneration. And this OHSU proprietary technology has been filed as both U.S. and international patents, the U.S. patent having recently been approved. As one might expect, there is great interest by many large pharmaceutical and smaller biotech companies in this area of drug development. During the past year, I have visited a large number of such companies that have expressed interest in my work. Many of these companies have designed compounds that are structurally similar to FK-506 and the Vertex compound. They have interest in testing them in animal models of human neurological disorders. And my technology will enable them to screen literally hundreds of thousands of such libraries of compounds that they have for drug development. OHSU is in the process of finding suitable licensees for this technology. Such arrangements will hopefully provide funding for my laboratory to continue such studies in our animal models. While my encounters with industry have revealed great interest by these companies for studies related to human neurodegenerative disorders, including Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease, unfortunately, I have found little or no interest in support for studies of spinal cord injury. To be frank, I have been told that there is just not enough potential profit in this area to justify a research venture. One exception is a company in New Jersey, Integra Life Sciences, which makes artificial nerve bridges, which can reconnect transected nerves. And we have found that FK-506, as well as these other drugs, help in the nerve bridges to work. And this company has assembled a group of internationally respected researchers to develop a cure for spinal cord injury. It is recognized that no single procedure is likely to be successful alone. These other researchers have engaged in studies that have generated much excitement recently. For example, as was just mentioned at the onset of before I spoke, advances using stem cells. And these are cells which are able to become new nerve cells under appropriate conditions, as well as another exciting area which you may not be aware of, olfactory endothelial cells. And these are specialized cells in the nose that are non-nerve cells, but in the appropriate areas can actually help the nerves to grow over long distances by providing a favorable environment for nerves to exist in. I am pleased to be a member of this group, and it is enabling me for my work to be integrated with these other approaches and allows Oregon to play a role in this international effort. In summary, my laboratory has made an exciting discovery which may lead to the development of the first drugs to aid nerve regeneration. While we have generated some promising new data on spinal cord injury, our ability to move rapidly in this area is severely limited by the availability of funding. I would like to close by noting that in the past year, following stories of my work, which you may be familiar with in the Wall Street Journal and Willamette Week last May, I received numerous emails, letters, and phone calls from Oregonians, one of whom was a woman with spinal cord injury from Riverside, Oregon. All have expressed their gratitude and encouragement from my work. They were previously unaware that this research has been going on in OHSU and are proud to learn that such activities exist in their state. At the same time, they recognize the need for more research in this area. Senate Bill 540 provides an opportunity for Oregon to advance this pioneering area of research and at the same time help people throughout the state. Thank you.
Doctor, I wish we had time to have you go into a little detail on what you've done, because when you started talking about this, I realized in 5 minutes you're going over hundreds and hundreds of hours of research and other probably very exciting prospects here if you have a chance to do a little bit of brainstorming with how this can help folks that are in a real tragic situation. And would you have any, our bill so far has a blank on the page 2, third to the last line, line 31, with a dollar sign on it. Would you have any idea of what would be a helpful amount to insert in that?
Sure.
With your knowledge of what these programs cost and what it costs to get a grant going and so forth.
Yeah. Just to give some perspective, NIH grants would typically run in the range of $100,000 to $200,000 a year in direct cost to researchers. That's a large grant. I have been successful in getting grants in the past from smaller agencies like the Paralyzed Veterans of America, which typically give out grants in the range of $25,000 to $50,000. And those are sometimes over a two-year period, which is substantial to do significant work. For the types of things that this could be helpful to in generating, work in promising areas, I would typically think that in the range of a $25,000 or so grant for a year is something that a researcher could get the types of data together that would be successfully able to apply for larger types of funding.
But if you would be, as this bill asks, to have a board to disperse money and instruct the grant applicants, this really is money for grant applicants. So if you say that a $25,000 grant might do for one of your things, it certainly wouldn't run a board or provide for any office help or anything like that in the process. So it would have to be somewhere, I would guess, in the $100,000 bracket to be significant.
Well, I'm not really here to speak the specifics of the finances, I would say that, as I said at the onset, I'm here representing many researchers on the Hill that are doing some very exciting work. There's a woman, a Dr. Faye Hogan, who's at what was the Dow Institute of Neurological Sciences at Legacy Good Sam, that's now part of OHSU, and she works specifically with patients and doing some very groundbreaking work on helping to restore control, so that that is to say that the pool of money obviously would have to go through the normal peer review process, which is what I like and how this is set up, and distributed according to how many people apply and reach a level that the committee feels are a good enough grant to fund. And so I think that's going to vary in numbers of years in terms of how many researchers are putting in grants of sufficient quality and merit, and that's difficult to really say. So that probably is maybe more important than even the mechanics of running of the committee.
I certainly thank you for taking your valuable time. Are there questions or questions for Dr. Moore? Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And we appreciate your helpful education on this matter. And I know there are many people in this state and other states that stand to benefit from the work you're doing. We wish you every success.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be sent forward to Ways and Means with a two-pass recommendation. Do you need an amount in there, please?
I was wondering. We forgot an amount on a previous bill, and I was just going to ask the staff here, after we get done with this, if there's a chance to go back and revisit that and put in an amount, because we have the one where we discussed the 50% figure we didn't put that in.
We talked about 1.35.
Yeah, I know, but...
Didn't we put it in?
No, we didn't actually recommend that, so I think we need to straighten that out.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
You were suggesting $100,000. Is that something you want to put in and just let them work with it?
Well, I would be willing to discuss it with the committee here.
I'm in agreement.
At least would be a start.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps by the time it gets to Ways and Means and we have an opportunity to discuss it there, others can come up with figures where we could start with that. I'd be...
You want my...
Certainly.
Do I need to... Do I need to...
I don't know. I would just include it in the motion, I think.
Okay, I move Senate Bill 540 to the Ways and Means with the due-pass recommendation that we use $1,100,000 in this.
Right. Senator Duncan has moved that we send Senate Bill 540 with a figure of $100,000 in the dollar amount to the Ways and Means Committee with a due-pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, so ordered. I'm sorry. We'll call the roll.
Member Sanders?
Aye.
Member Joe?
Aye.
Member Castillo?
Aye.
Member Duncan?
Aye.
Member Hill?
Aye. Motion's carried. Maybe staff can look into what we have to go through here as we go on to Senate Bill, open a work, the closed work session on Senate Bill 540 and open a work session on Senate Bill 611. We made it. Abby Hopper and Sue Wilson. Senator Shields and I are ready to go on to another chapter of midwifery here.
Yeah, we did this in 1993.
We've been involved in this from day one.
I hear you.
I just want another candy bar when it's over.
That looks like good.
I'll wait for you.
Okay. Go right ahead.
Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Susan Wilson. I am the administrator for the Health Licensing Office, and I've been asked by Senator Fisher to answer some questions regarding the viability of the Board of Directing to Midwifery as it relates to the repeal of the sunset in Senate Bill 611. Just to give you a brief background, and it sounds like you've heard a lot of information and past testimony. The 1993 legislature enacted a licensing law regulation of direct injury midwives. And the plan was to improve access to maternity care in Oregon. And the goal was to accomplish this under a coordinated state health care insurance plan and third-party reimbursement. Over the years, I think the program and board have seen a decline in licensees primarily. There's some speculation that is due to the third-party reimbursement issue. But let me give you a little idea of why the board was sent to our office. It was envisioned at the time that the operations for such a small board could be accomplished in a shared office or a consolidated office, and currently we have 9 boards and programs within our office, and we share a staff and general services for those boards as they relate to licensing, examination, and disciplinary action. Those boards range from respiratory care therapists to direct injury midwifery, and in my testimony, I've given you a list of those boards currently within this office. All are other funded and all are supported by fees from the licensees that are licensed by those boards and programs. The administrative staff carries out the licensing and regulatory functions. We're a professional staff that provides a balance to ensure that the legal and administrative services are provided in an adequate manner under government standards. For the past 3 biennium, we have testified and also reported to the legislature that the 33 licensed direct injury midwives have had to carry a rather large burden of supporting a very big government regulatory board. We have seen a diminished group of licensed direct injury midwives. In fact, it's dropped from 54 in 1993 to as low as 26, and today we're at about 33. So some of the factors that we think have caused the insufficient funding and revenue base is the 1997-99 litigation and legal costs that have exhausted revenues for this biennium, leaving a debt or carryover debt for the next biennium of $13,000 or more. That's the debt as of today in legal costs. The inadequate fees, the number of licensees balanced against those inadequate fees, even though they were raised in $500, it's still not enough to support the program. The lack or mechanism to enact the reimbursement process in order for this group to receive third-party reimbursement. I think we have made some headway in at least opening discussions on that issue. And, of course, there's no statutory authority for the programs that are currently operating within our office in this fee-generated program to cover any of, or augment any of the costs for direct injury midwives. So even with the efficiencies that we found in our office, there are just some I think really important issues that the committee I know has already considered as they relate to the continuation of this board. And the possibilities include raising fees, finding a subsidy, and I think looking at some point to the licensing group and finding out what standards should apply to what population of this licensing group. I do want to point out that the board, and I believe the association, I'm sure they testified to this, is not supportive of mandatory licensure, even though that has been an aspect that has been looked at.
That's correct. I got that loud and clear.
I wanted to be on the record.
Yeah, that was something that I also supported very wholeheartedly at the beginning.
I wanted to make sure you... Are there any questions that I might answer? Sure.
Yes, go ahead. Thanks.
I'm very supportive of the role that the direct entry midwives play in our healthcare system. We play a very, very important role here in our state. I am concerned and want to see this be successful, and I know you do too, and so I know that plans are for in the interim to really work on how you guys are going to, you know, resolve your the financial problems with how the licensing program is working right now. I just have a concern that you have this $13,000 debt and legal expenses. What happens if you get, you know, just one case this next time? I mean, was this just based on one case, the $13,000, or was that more than?
Excuse me. Yes, Senator, it was based on just one case.
And, yeah, well, I guess I don't, I mean, I'm not telling you anything new by saying that I know that you all are concerned about what this means for the future, too. If you had just one more, then there's another huge expense for the licensing program. So I just wish you the best of luck in trying to come up with a solution and a plan for the future of this program, because it is very important. And I understand why you don't want it to be a mandatory program. Hopefully you can make it a successful one without going down that route.
We have an amendment that would allow them to take in grants, donations, contributions, and things like that for the purpose of helping out. And I understand there's some interest in doing that. I believe an effort already is going around to assess members or to try to bring money in, and I've heard some good reports so far to respond to that. I would have to say I have never seen a group so eager to tax themselves to have a board as I have this board, and I commend you for that. It's very frustrating to me to have to see the way this has happened and the way that it's come out. I would also commend you for not turning your back on a situation and saying we don't have the money to fight it, but you are willing to police yourself and discipline yourselves, and I commend you again for that. It makes me feel good for having supported you and the fact that you've taken on responsibility and maturity in a board that doesn't have really the time and experience to be mature yet. So I think you've done well, and I have tried. I thought perhaps when we increased the amount of the Board of Pharmacy could use the lives of some of their problems, that I was misunderstood and thought that was from the general fund, only to find out that it just was authorizing them to use more money from their reserves, and you haven't been going long enough to have any reserves. So that wasn't a help either, and there is a possibility of loan, and I believe those are no-interest loans from the general fund that possibly have been done, but that would have to basically be paid back, and that would not really answer the problem. They would only postpone the day of reckoning. So I don't know any other way. You say this really doesn't, and it doesn't, to my knowledge, help and allay the problem that you have in funding within the bill as it stands now. So I'm guessing we would need a further amendment that would allow the board to raise the assessments up in order to keep this non-mandatory. It would have to about open that up for them to charge what was necessary to actually pay the bill, and that scares me a little bit because it's going to be a healthy charge to the members, and you're taking on a real obligation. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher. it is miraculous when you look at the figure. I mean, we feel we're a group that certainly has the motto of "We shall not be daunted," for sure. I do want to acknowledge the support that we felt from the committee completely, and I also want to acknowledge the fact that we, you know, part of me wants to say, well, you know, we want to raise our fees, but there's this other part of me that says,
I don't think we got that.
My point exactly.
I want that on the record.
But we are, you know, we feel so committed, of course. They chose, of course, one person is probably the most emotional out of the group. It's a passionate subject for me.
One thing that stands you good stead when you go out and do your job.
Well, we are committed. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we are committed to taking responsibility for this. And in the past 2 weeks, I would like to review with you what we've done. We are quite honestly looking at raising our fees in order to come up with an actual solution to our fiscal issue. And those are undauntingly large, it's true. We have had we've had 30 licensed midwives who have signed. We do, and if I can just acknowledge they're from the girls. I mean, if they would just raise their hands or, you know, smile, I'm sure you recognize them.
Yes.
But,
wow. Thank you.
They're from all parts of Oregon, the coast, central Oregon, eastern Oregon, southern Oregon, Salem, Corvallis, Eugene, etc. But what they have been doing in the past couple weeks is they have sort of taken the ball and run with it, and we have they have individually, of course, pledged to this undaunted raise that scares us all, but they have pledged that, and the reason why they feel secure in that is they have also gone out and sought pledges from, and we've put together this amendment because we would like to receive grants, et cetera, through the board, but they have also gone out to the community, and we have been doing fundraisers. We have, in fundraisers alone, we raised over $10,000. We have $15,000 in pledges for the next 2 years. That means $15,000 a year. And you saw that could be used in two ways. It could be used in terms of so that we wouldn't have to raise our licensing fees quite so much, and that would go towards the working of our board. And the other way that we saw that, if that wasn't able to happen and we had to raise our fees to this amount that this is so unbearable to say, but we're willing to do wholeheartedly, is we would use that in terms of a scholarship fund to help midwives to make sure that every midwife would be able to pay that fee. We are, of course, 100% committed to that, and to, of course, the College of Midwifery. And I heard the mandatory issue come up. Of course, it's come up in our group again and again and again, and we take it very seriously. We don't want to do it as an 11th hour crisis move because we don't believe it will solve our fiscal problem. We don't want to come back to you in a year and say, gosh, you know, we went mandatory, two extra midwives signed up. We're still in the same boat. There have been a lot of numbers thrown out for unlicensed midwives, but I can tell you, unless you're counting Bigfoot sightings, we know specifically of about 60 unlicensed midwives. And of those midwives, what I just want you to know is that a lot of those midwives, there are 33 licensed midwives. The majority of us have apprentices, and they're all working on their numbers. They're called supervised midwives. They're working towards their licensing numbers. They are all signing birth certificates. They are not ready to be signed up. There are midwives in the community who, of course, as you all know, work in terms of their cultural group or their religious group. They will not be running to sign up for mandatory licensure. The numbers are small. They do not work out. And we don't want a solution that is not going to work. I mean, we are
going off of the legislative fiscal, even if you have mandatory licensing, it's still...
It's just not going to be...
It doesn't come up and meet the...
Sure, I have a question. We're going to have a call. Let's end in about a minute here. Do you want to wait, or do you want to move the dash to them, or do we have another one?
What my feeling would be here that we have certainly seen the outpouring. I don't want you folks to have to come back and hand, but I think the committee is behind you, and what I would recommend that we do is this will have to go to the Ways and Means Committee. So what we need to do is to adopt language that would allow the board to increase its fees enough to cover whatever amounts that you get from donations and grants and things like that would not cover, and allow the board to have the authority to work within that framework. And that's kind of an unusual thing to do in a way, but I think that you've indicated a kind of an unusual interest in your board and things, and I can truthfully say that I haven't seen an interest in board matters. It's a good thing some of the boards have over 1,700 members and stuff haven't taken the interest that you have today, or we wouldn't have the chairs in the Capitol this weekend.
Does that mean that we'll have another amendment?
I think we should do that. We should do that. Legislative fiscal already has some figures. Mm-hmm. They have done some work on that and shown me the figures. And so perhaps using that information, we can...
Why do we need another amendment? Can we pass dash two, put it in Ways and Means, and let them further amend it?
I think these things basically have to go through the substantive committee if we do the board merging or raise.
There's the call.
Yeah.
Do they want an additional amendment to the dash two?
Well, we could do it as a dash three, or if the fiscal or legislative council wants to make it all one amendment, that's all right too. But I think we ought to include and just take a little more time here, because I don't believe it's going to... Well, this could get a quick hearing down here, because this wouldn't involve funds, so we could get this right on two ways to me. So I think that we ought to do that as quick as we can. Try to bring it back Monday and work it Monday. Well, it would be something similar to what the Board of Nursing had in and increasing their, allow them to increase the $500 limit up to, and we should have legislative fiscal give us an amount that would cover it without any donations and grants, and then allow the board, because I believe your board is working in your behalf, to carry that on according to what funds they had to work with.
Is it
legal
to do that in Ways and Means?
I don't see any reason. We could do it here, and then that Ways and Means would okay the budget bill. Then it could come to the floor and be voted on, and I think it would remote call it.
This doesn't deal with this one, but I'm just curious what we're going to do. I know the ashes are here from Lake Oswego. So what do we, is there a minor thing we could quickly do, or is it a technique? But if not,
I think we've got some amendments that need.
Does that feel fair?
I'm
waiting.
I support the amendment, as is.
And that's the bill. 755. If they don't come down with the police and take us out of here, if I can close this work session, if that's okay with you, we'll do that and have it back in Monday.
And one of the things I want to make sure of, you can help Sandy or so we're here on amendments.
And legislative fiscal has the figures.
And my only other comment very quickly is that you might consider on your board trying to get somebody from Fred Meyer Charitable Fallen Foundation.
Working on that.
Okay, close the work session on Senate Bill 611. Thank all of you for coming and being so patient, and thank you also for your contributions to our Oregon society. Open the work session on Senate Bill 765.
I move the amendment. Okay, this is the deck.
Okay.
I move the dash one amendment. Dash two amendments.
No. Wait, they're in a work session.
Yeah, that's all right. You could quickly go out ahead. we'll try to listen above. Tell us about your amendments as quick as you can here.
Okay.
Here they are. Lisa will be here in a second.
I'm Barbara Ash. I'm here to represent House Bill 765, which creates a task force for Oregon's Children with Autism Task Force. The Department of Education has reviewed Dash 2, the proposed amendment to Senate Bill 765, and agrees to the amendments. Also, Sonia Fisher, Catherine White, and I agree with the Dash 2 amendments.
I move the Dash 2 amendments, Mr. Chair. Senator Duncan is moving the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 765. Is there further discussion?
No.
Objection?
I move
765. As amended to the
just a second. Did it add the emergency
clause? No.
Okay, thanks. Okay, right. Okay.
More about it.
That's all I wanted to know.
I move it to,
does this go to the floor?
Go to waste meeting too, I believe.
No.
I move it to
the fiscal. The fiscal says, for the purpose, and since the task force, personal services cost
for
the animal
would be $75,000. For the record, I took the money out of it so it doesn't have to go to waste. It needs an emergency clause.
Well,
this
is on the original bill.
Right, and the lady from the department says it doesn't need a fiscal, right? I saw you shaking it.
On the Dash 2 amendments, the Department of Education supported those amendments. I don't know that they already have an autism group that is meeting. My guess is that they would just expand the group that is already meeting, and I don't know that there will be a fiscal, but I can't really speak to that.
Well, the president can send it there if you do it well.
Let's do it this way.
Send it to the forum.
If we find something else. I will hear from the department.
Yes.
Okay.
And just real quickly before we take the vote, I have to tell you that on the dashboard, which I had an opportunity to review, there is language declaring an emergency. I do not see that language on the Dash 2. So I do not get a sense that the 2s have incorporated the 1s. I'm not sure. Like I said, this is just handed to me, but
would
I do
you
not
like to add that to the House side? Yeah.
Okay. Move it to the floor with the due pass representative. Duncan can move Senate Bill 765 with the Dash 2 amendments to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
I'm up
for the Shields. Aye. And motion carries, and Senator Duncan has volunteered to carry the bill. Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're in the meeting of the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services.
Are you taking all the rest of these up for Monday?
Just put them on Monday. And,